Okay, so take it away. Okay. So there's a quiz to start with. The theorist has to answer. What is this? No, you're not a theorist, Scott. What? Can any theorist tell me what this is?
A dark cloud?
No.
Ask a silly question.
All right. So it says there, come tomorrow to hear exactly what this is. Okay. So what that actually was, now maybe you recognize it from its non-optical view here. Mark, what is this now?
Perseus.
Very good. Okay.
The fact that it recognized the CO contours better than the optical.
I think this is twisted. Okay. So anyway, I'm here to pose some questions to start off the week, and I'm not here today to talk about COMPLETE, which is where a lot of the data that you see here come from, or C2D, which is where a lot of the other data that it's very hard to see here right now come from. As we talked about at lunch, we'll be talking about that and how those things relate to each other all week. But instead, I just wanted to introduce everybody. Let me see. Is Paul Goldsmith, when is he coming? He's the only person who wasn't here.
Tomorrow.
Okay, so Paul wasn't here. I think not quite everybody was at lunch. So these are the people who are here specially for the survey week. And so from COMPLETE, we have myself and Jens Kaufman, who happens to have his hand up over there. Jaime Pineda, here we go. Scott. Rahul is somewhere. There we go. Good. And then we have Neil and Melissa and Jens again and Phil and Debbie Padgett. And then again, to talk about Taurus and the big FCRIO survey there, we'll have Paul Goldsmith. Mark Heyer was here earlier in the program, but he couldn't come back this week. And then we have Debbie Padgett again to talk about the Taurus survey that she's done.
And
Neil and Phil are on that. Oh, I missed. Sorry. There's too much cross-pollination. Okay. And then the Spitzer Cluster survey. Well, Phil, okay, you can you win the prize for three? Is it? Anyway, so, all right, we'll edit these later. Again, to talk about the taste testing, there are some theorists who have already been involved. Where's Mark Krumholz? He fell off the bottom. He's the most actively involved. Sorry, Mark. Anyway, I'll fix these slides for you. But anyway, so that's enough for introductions. And so then what I did, and what I should say Chris and I did, because Chris has looked at this list as well, is I went through and just wrote down a whole big long list of questions for stars. I'll go back in a minute for gas and for stars and gas. Okay, I'm going to go back to these questions in a minute. Okay, but what I just wanted to say is that at the end here, what you have is a handout, and it says, here's Aki Nordlund's list. I'm going through this very quickly because, Chris, at lunchtime I said most of what I was going to say now. So I apologize to anyone who wasn't there at lunchtime. I could say it again, but then I would bore about 90% of the people in the room, so sorry. But anyway, so Aki Nordlund posted this long list of questions about star formation, and there's a discussion on the wiki of some answers. This is linked, by the way. These slides are now all available online. You can go look at this. And the question is whether or not we'd like to fill out three easier questions that we might be able to answer as the outcome of this week. So let me go back to just these lists. And you have some handouts there that have the questions written on them. And what I'm hoping is that we can take a little poll here for the stuff we forgot. That's really important. So let's just look at the list here. One thing, again, that came up at lunch was, have we actually, or do we have a capability now to find, quote-unquote, all the young stars in region surveyed? And do we no longer have this problem that we had when there was only IRAS-like resolution and sensitivity, that a lot of stars that actually were multiples got lumped together? So there's another question down here. What is the full story on multiplicity? And then there's this issue about mass.
Before you go on.
Yeah.
So is this issue then entirely one of multiplicity, or is it also
sensitivity? Both.
So what sensitivity now with Spitzer from nearby clouds down to what mass star can you see?
I'm pointing to Neil to answer that question. I know. I think I'm supposed to be introducing this here. So yes, you'll hear.
Excuse me. Yes, but perhaps it's not only a question of sensitivity, because with lines you can also, without flow, unveil stars without seeing clearly them in emission transmission.
That's an interesting point. In the outflow survey, actually, that we've been doing with the complete data, there are several candidate outflows that have no known source, even now.
Well, and certainly in more distant regions for, you know, sort of massive cores.
Yeah.
There's a very recent paper by Federica Mott where she showed that even the infrared quiet massive cores have outflow tracers.
Okay, so we have to revise. We've gotten to the second question, or the first question.
The first question is you have to identify the stars first, and since you'll only identify stars with infrared accesses, so you might be looting out 20 to 30% of the stars just since you see them.
That's right. Wow. Okay, that's why all was in quotes, but.
We haven't even covered all of the star forming
regions. Of course not. Of course not. It says in region survey. But actually, there's another point here. Right, right. there's another point, which is a favorite one of my own, which is that if you actually have any stars that have significant velocity, they will have actually left the region that's been surveyed. So those are stars that formed in that region, but you don't see them. So let me just keep going. All right, so then there's this issue about the mass function that came up in the context of gas and dust at lunch, and how does that relate to the stellar mass function. But here, when it turns to a question just about stars, there's the issue of that you measure the mass function now, right? And there's this time evolution where you don't. It's not really the initial mass function, right? Unless you believe in some sort of magical coeval or accelerated star formation, which some people do. But there's an issue of how you relate what you see now, which is also, by the way, a luminosity function, not a mass function, to a real mass function. So is that the IMF? Okay, so I'm just going to skip this because I mentioned it. Best way to measure stellar ages. Right. So there's sort of a gross measurement, which you can do from the colors, right? But as Tom was just pointing out, even if you have a full spectral energy distribution, you can actually still make mistakes, and in particular, you'll miss the older stars that don't have some obvious feature in spectral energy distribution. And so that gets to what's the definition of a quote-unquote young star in the first place, okay, which we'll get to our timescale question in a minute. But one thing I should say there, to come back to this point about outflows, people have also tried to use outflows to date young stars, and it turns out that there's been a number of recent papers, some by Hector Arce, that actually show that you can't do that because outflows, like the young stars themselves, are episodic. And so what an outflow is doing and how collimated it is and how strong it is can actually unfortunately vary in addition to secularly, stochastically, as a function of time. And so you need a really big sample to use that to do out ages. Okay, so speaking of outflows, what's the prevalence and the properties of outflows and shells? That's something that you'll see in the data that we'll see later in the week, and it's rather hard to count. And this is all going to drive me personally back to this idea that if we had simulations that really were simulations of reality, it would be nice to know what the biases, the particular tracers we're using, and the particular telescopes we're using are doing to our real detection sensitivity for these kinds of things, and also what the structure of the medium itself is doing in terms of things like finding shells. Okay, and so what have we learned, if anything, about the timing or sequence of star formation? I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second when I come to Telemachus's figure about how we count time without stars and time with stars to count the ages of clouds in the lifetime of star formation. But I think that a picture where you have a cloud and it sort of does nothing for a while and then it forms all its stars and then it's done and it does it all together is rare or ruled out. I don't know. And this is, again, this is my own personal philosophy. You can argue with me. So I think that there's some mixture in the timing and the sequence, which really you need large surveys like what we have here today to have enough samples to say something. Chris added his favorite recent question here, why are protostars faint? And again, we discussed that at lunch a little bit. and this inadequacy potentially of the time variability argument for answering that. What can we agree was the biggest stellar surprise? To put that in there sort of in the same category of stuff we forgot. Okay, so in other words, in all of the surveys that we're going to talk about this week, in terms of the stars and stellar population and their properties, you know, what did you, Tom, see, you know, that went, oh, wow, you know, that hurt my head. So, I don't know. Gas. Okay, this is this true column density distribution question is one which is much more subtle than you would think. And I'm going to talk about that a lot tomorrow, so I'm not going to talk about it now. I already started to talk about what does this clump mass function really mean at lunch. A simple question, what is the temperature distribution in the gas? Most of the simulations take the gas to be isothermal, which on a gross scale is somewhat realistic. But the paper that we were talking about on the way in here, which is a giant ammonia survey that several people in the room are involved with, Eric Rozalowski is the first author and it's on AstroPH today, actually has the temperatures for many ammonia cores in Perseus gotten from ammonia 1.1 and 2.2, and they're not all the same. And the big surveys that have been done, actually not with gas but with dust, show you that there are very substantial temperature variations in the dust, in particular associated with big shells that are actually interacting with the molecular gas. So both on the small scale and on a large scale, I think there are variations. Kinematic processes that describe gas motions at what scales? Right, so you can pretend that you have this turbulent cascade which is driven by some magical force and not worry about kind of small scale or local effects. And then you might just have these first couple. But in fact, you also have, you know, real gravitational infall and then real but stochastic, you know, potentially colliding streams, as people like to call them, and then you have outflows. Okay. And didn't I say this already? Okay. It was in the other one. I guess it's gas and stars, right? Okay. How bound is the gas to what and where? Right. So this is another... to what, meaning to the stars, to the gas. In other words, people actually forget about the stars a lot of times when they calculate gravity in these regions. And it turns out that in regions that have formed a lot of stars, that the gravity of the stars is actually critical to whether or not the gas is still bound. People used to think about that a long time ago when people first started studying star formation, but I realize that people have forgotten to think about that sometimes recently. Okay. What's between the clumps? Here's another Chris question. He'd like to know what's the nature of the interclump medium. So I think first we have to define what a clump is, to everyone's agreement. But the idea is that you have all this molecular gas, and we know that it's filamentary and messy, and what's between these filaments? Is it all molecular? Is it empty? Is it ionized? Is it a different temperature within molecular clouds? Then there's the classic, how important is the magnetic field? As we know, a lot of the simulations don't include magnetic fields. Some do. We know, where's Dick? We have many magnetic field observations and arduously collected. And it shows that when you can measure the magnetic field, it's often close to the critical value, but often you can't measure it, which might suggest that the magnetic field is not always strong enough to be dynamically important.
I might point out that this kind of studies are getting close to being called surveys, because there's been quite a bit of work in the last, say, 7-8 years. And so the number of objects that have been looked at with great sensitivity, whether it's molecular clouds or clumps or floors, is some order of 100 now.
That's a good point.
It's not all at one overall cloud, but it's a large enough number that I could consider to be a survey.
That's a good point. And the answer is? I would have loved to be here. Okay. All right. Can we tell how long various structures last? That, again, I'll come back to that in the stars and gas slide in a minute. But the idea is that certain theories would tell you that the structures that you see now are very transient. Other ones would have them last for a long time. And if you're going to have that kind of discrepancy, it's hard to define what the lifetime of something is. when the something isn't the thing, that itself is transient, but something that contains those things, or that is contained within those things. Okay. What can we agree with the biggest gaseous surprise? That sounds awful. Let's leave that one alone. Okay. And then there's the stuff we forgot line, which you should feel free to fill in on your handouts. And by the way, we'll take the contributions for what we forgot in the form of questions that we might want to address. Okay, now making stars from gas, right? So this is something that Melissa and Neil were talking about at lunch. What fraction of gas is actually converted to stars, and at what point in this whole process does that happen? What happens to the rest of the gas, right? So in other words, when is a cloud not a cloud, or when is it done forming stars? I think that this definition thing and this time scale definition of the, in other words, the def, here, I'll just go to this. Okay, so Telemachus, Muscovius, and Tacitus published this paper a few years ago, which caused a great deal of controversy, but it has this nice figure, okay, that says we really should think of the evolution in star formation as something, a process where you go from mean densities of about 100 to 1,000 particles per cubic centimeter, and then you form these starless core-like things, okay, but what's the definition of a starless core? Then you have actual accretion within the core, and then you form actual young stars here, which stay youngish for a long time. And that the sum of all of these things can be something like 10 million years. And that's probably not something that you want to argue that much with, because you can make the ends of the arrow go a little fuzzy, and so 10 million years seems fine. The argument is about, what are these things? In other words, what's the duration of these things, and how...
This doesn't make any sense to me, because the last one on the Kelvin-Helmholtz time has to do with the star. It has nothing to do with the interstellar medium. And if you go to lower and lower mass stars, I mean, you said 10 million years, that's appropriate maybe for a lower mass star, but if I go to a brown dwarf, it's 10 to 90.
That's true.
So it seems to me once you've essentially gotten to the final mass of the star, we should say how the star is formed.
That's a good proposal for unfuzzying this end of the spectrum. I think that that's fair. And I'm showing this now to show what I think is the ambiguity in all of these timescales and why people have arguments that sometimes they're actually not even disagreeing with each other. Okay,
that's
so
the only ages that you can sorry, you know, these,
No. I that's what this is.
The only ages that you can get is true. What you're saying is true. The only ages that you can get actually with a reasonable amount of confidence is that part that you are now taking out.
This one.
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting for premed sequence evolution, sure. But that's not the age of star formation.
Well.
And so I agree that the phase A and B are very uncertain, but that's what we want to know.
Right, so if what I think Telemachus, if he were here, well, I don't know what he would say exactly, but one thing he would say is that what he was talking about was the duration of star formation, right, which he says ends when you get the main sequence stars.
I think that it's not really when the main sequence, because as
Chris was saying, it depends what kind of star, yes.
On the mass. It's when most of the stars in that given ensemble have formed.
Right, I think you could do it by some sort of...
That includes both very young stars and older stars.
Right, if you did it by... What I'm thinking is that if you actually defined a box, and then you make it some sort of co-moving box, okay, but it's a box that moves with the galaxy, and then you basically say, I'm going to start this at time zero with a density of this, okay, and then at what point has that box been converted to what percentage of stars, and just make a timeline of that, is how I personally would answer this question. And I wouldn't do the semantics of clumps and clouds and cores. And
but then you need to know where the box is going to be on the timing.
All I'm doing is letting it rotate with the galaxy.
Well, it depends whether it is in a self-validating GMC or in a diffuse cloud.
Oh, no, it's a very big box. You're right, but the problem is how big is the box, right? So in other words, even within a GMC, if you have some motion of the GMC as a whole, you don't even know how to let the box rotate with the GMC. But acknowledging that there are these problems would actually potentially stop people from making the kind of global statements that they want to make. And I just think people have to be more specific.
Tom Abel over here, he had a long discussion about this, that he agrees that it's possible, to have some definition of a GMC, and you could take a photograph of the sky now and say, well, this is a GMC, at least because it would be. But then his argument is that it's extremely difficult to imagine trying to come back, say, 1 or 10 million years later
and find the same
what the relation is between that, because you're going to have, is it equal to apply? You have some of the molecular gas got turned into atomic gas, some of the atomic gas that got turned into molecular gas, some got blown out, some fell in. And it becomes a very difficult.
So maybe one of our questions should be how to define this process in a way that we can calculate efficiencies that everybody agrees what they mean. That would be quite a challenge. It seems like algebra, but it would be a challenge. Okay. Right. So that's just the first one. What happens to the rest? That's the second one. How much does environment matter? So I think that this is, when it comes to sort of the competing pictures for star formation today, this is really how I think about the difference between them. In other words, you have this sort of quasi-static view where it doesn't matter much what's out there, except that maybe it's providing some sort of constant pressure that makes it more of a Bonner-Ebert sphere than an isothermal sphere. And then you have another scenario, which is a little bit more extreme, where you have some happenstance collision of streams in some sort of turbulent flow that'll give a little extra push beyond what you would get from gravity, or that will make a shock that will fragment into things like cores. And then there's the most extreme scenario, this competitive accretion, where you have the environment constantly changing, and even the reservoir that something is accreting from potentially changing. And so that's what I mean by how much does environment matter. And there is the possibility that within these different environments that you can have this kind of quasi-static picture, and that there is something that's like what has been called a coherent core or a kernel that has a nearly thermal line within. It's kind of going about its business collapsing, but that it's going about it in very different environments, but that the environment doesn't matter very much. So that's what that question means. Chris added one of his other favorite questions, how do massive stars form? One for the ages, which we may never answer. role of feedback, right? So not just shells and things like that, but also the idea that the stars themselves and time changes the chemistry of the regions, which ultimately does things like change the ionization, which changes the coupling to the magnetic field, etc. Okay, when are stars lost from the cloud? I alluded to that before. You also have to, in calculating these efficiencies, count the stars that are lost from the gas that you see now. And then the last thing I had was this diagram, which we already talked about. And so we shouldn't forget dust. And so on this list of questions, these are a little bit simpler, I think. You want to know whether the gas and the dust temperature are really coupled. And, the idea is that they would be coupled at very high density. But I don't know if it's just a matter of density or if there's something more complicated going on. Are they actually well mixed? If Paolo was here, he might say something about the idea that the gas and the dust are not necessarily tracing exactly the same thing in certain regimes. How does extinction vary with wavelength, and how much does that vary? That's something else that came up with lunch, this idea that you can have a variation in the optical properties of dust, which is exactly the same question as how does the opacity vary, except that there's different chemical effects that will affect things at short wavelengths and at long wavelengths. And then, again, this came up at lunch. See, I told you we said everything at lunch, right? Is there evidence for grain growth? And if so, where? All right, so the last thing I wanted to show, other than to remind you that I'd like to think about whether or not we can have these questions, is just another thing that came up at lunch, that we have these three different kind of interactive spaces, this one being the least interactive. So these slides are on the wiki and on the Basecamp now, and so you can go play with this. And I'm not going to click on the links now, but you can click on any of these and get to these places. And so this is the simulation repository, CADAC, that we were talking about earlier. This is the wiki for this meeting that you've probably all seen. And this is the somewhat fancier wiki than a wiki, which is called a Basecamp. That's what the company calls it. And we call it the taste testing or star formation taste tests area. And so these files have been posted here. And this one was meant for conversations of particularly this little triangle here, which shows you that rather than going directly comparing observations and simulations, what might be more effective is to come up with these mechanisms for actually observing the simulations, not just the rate of transfer, but actually the properties of the observing system as well, and then comparing them through those mechanisms, the observations and the simulations. And you can actually do the same thing with the analytic ideas, as well as the standard and the comparisons of all those things. So that's what I wanted to say. And Phil, I'm going to leave this for you. And maybe if you want to hang on to these lists during the week and refer back to them and see, you know, during our discussions what keeps coming up over and over again, maybe we can agree over coffee and lunches and dinners toward the end of the week and see if we can make some progress as a result. Thank you. Okay, and so now we'll move on to Neil, who is going to give the first real talk of our... You know, that was not a talk. It's okay. That was purely an introduction. This is a real talk. Oh, you want me to take this off? Yeah. Okay. And Neil and Melissa are both going to give us glimpses of C2D and results. Do you want this thing?
I've got mine.
Okay. Results from C2D over the next couple of days. And they and I are wondering how much people, especially the theorists who are here, would like to know more details of kind of what's available from C2D in terms of the observations rather than just results. And so if you can tell Melissa and Neil that after Neil's talk, Melissa and Neil can adjust what they're going to do tomorrow. So you have your choice of results, data, or data and results.